You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate
and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world.
And now, innovation thought leader
and your super fly host,
Tamara Kleinberg.
What's up, Launch Streeters? Tamara here, your innovation guide and nature lover. I would spend all day among the trees, and actually in Lake Tahoe, if I could. So I've had a lot of conversations with you about taking the leap into entrepreneurship or just even a more entrepreneurial mindset. So I thought I'd bring on David Gee, the author of The Corporate Refugee Startup Guide and an entrepreneur himself, to talk about just that. He wrote the book because of his experience taking the big leap into that vast unknown. So I think whether you are looking to actually take that leap and launch your idea, or just be more entrepreneurial inside your organization, you're going to get a lot out of this conversation, especially when we talk about the fallacy of work-life balance. Oh my God, don't even get me started. How we may be looking at risk in the wrong way, and why being at rock bottom may actually be a good thing. This is a good conversation. So let's do this. Dave, thank you so much for joining me today. It's nice to talk to you again.
Hey, it was my pleasure, Tamara. Thanks for having me.
Since we are getting to know each other, we've only met once before, what's one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
Okay. I'm going to do two. Overachiever here.
Is that the first one?
Yeah. I was born in England, and I love home brewing. I'd say we're my first couple. So.
And did you jump on the home brewing bandwagon when it got popular, or have you been in it for a long time?
That's a good question. I've probably been doing it for about 10 years. We have this home brewing club near where I live, and a friend of mine kind of introduced me to it, and went from making the basic ales to doing crazy stuff like got a batch of red rummer, which I'm calling it red rummer, red ale, and with rum in it. It should be interesting.
It's interesting. My husband brews his own Applejack and apple brandy and all this stuff from apples in our backyard is where it started.
Oh, wow.
But there's something very, I would say that, I don't know if you find this, something very satisfying in the whole process of it and kind of that having that thing that you built at the end or made, yeah. I guess.
Yeah, 100%. Totally agree. And sometimes you put in so much time and sometimes money into it and you're crossing your fingers and you're like, God, I hope this works out really right. Well. And sometimes it doesn't, kind of like a startup, right?
I was going to say, that's actually the perfect segue into my first real question about being an entrepreneur, yeah. Which is exactly what it's like. So what made you to decide to leap and become an entrepreneur, or as you say, a corporate refugee?
Sure. So I spent most of my career, about 20 years, working in corporate. I worked for Fortune 500 companies, including Bell South, Motorola, TDS, USL. And then I went and worked for Humana. I wanted to kind of get out of the telecom space. And I worked for Humana for about 9 months. And the company merged our personal health insurance side and the small group side. And I was suddenly without a job for the first time in my career. And I made up about 60% of our household income at that point, and suddenly, poof, it had vanished.
That's painful.
And I, you know, at an early age, I'd had my own lawn mowing business, house painting business, like you hear from a lot of entrepreneurs. And I'd kind of parked it a little bit because it was, you know, too risky. And at this point, I started considering launching my own. I talked to some friends that weren't entrepreneurs and they said, gosh, that's not very safe. You should start looking for a job. And so I remember going out to LinkedIn and literally bile came up in the back of my mouth and to the point where it burned. And I said, I just cannot do this
I'm
again.
I'm only laughing in camaraderie because I think many of us have been there where you go to that next meeting or you – you know, whether you love your job and want to leave it or not, but that moment where you're like, oh my God, is this really it? Is this what I'm doing?
Right. 100%. Yep. Yeah. So that was, you know, that's kind of, I was an accidental entrepreneur, but I said, you know, to my wife, look, I really want to do this. I can't go back into corporate. And she basically said, fine, you've got $200 and need to be cash flow positive, you know, in 3 months. And, you know, the rest is history. So
I want to ask you two things about some stuff that you said that I think is really interesting. One is, you know, you're talking about taking the risk and then you put that aside. I'm curious how you define risk and maybe how you defined it back then when you were taking that leap. And I think risk is probably very top of mind, and how you think about it now.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think when you have a full-time income, let's say you're making $100,000 a year, you're putting that $100,000, you know, quote unquote, at risk. When you have nothing, like I did at that point, you know, I was, you know, kind of one of the attitudes I have is, look, I literally have nothing to lose. You know, I told my wife literally I would put in the $200 and nothing else. And you learn to, you know, scrape and just kind of claw your way into business and start generating cash. I think over time you do, you know, you take calculated risks, but you become, you know, I almost would say immune to some of the risks. So I launched my first startup and it was quote unquote risky, you know, because it was the opportunity cost of knowing and not getting another job. And the next one, I was, you know, like, hey, I'll do this, but I need to mitigate some risk. We went out and raised $500,000 in capital, which took some of the risk away. And now if I want to launch one, I'll go out, do some exploration. I might invest in one. And I go in with an attitude of, you know what, we're going to find a problem, find a solution. If this thing doesn't work out, that's okay. And I'll just move on to another one. So I think you could, you know, at least for me personally, I think, you know, I've just become more and more desensitized to the risk. But if I am going to take a risk, you know, especially it's with my own money now, usually I'm not launching, I'm helping others launch. It's a calculated risk. You know, there's a lot more time done on the front end doing research and discovery to make sure there's a problem and that, you know, we're fixing a problem.
Well, for launch readers out there, I want you to think about what Dave is saying that was so powerful about. What I heard is that we oftentimes create our perception of risk based on what we're losing, what we think we're losing anyway, not necessarily what's really ahead of us. And I think that's actually to a little bit of our detriment sometimes when that's really more the opportunity cost. The risk is just simply not knowing what the outcome is going to be, good or bad, and it can still be calculated.
Yep, absolutely. Yep.
So the second thing I wanted to ask you about is you said the whole $200, like go get, be cash positive. You know, I think urgency is part of being an entrepreneur, of having that kind of fire under your butt all the time. And I think as an innovator in a company or as an entrepreneur, you can actually leverage that to your advantage. And I'm wondering if, from your experience, if having that urgency actually helped you.
Yeah, you know, I think if I look at my peers, you know, and I'll say this with students as well. I think if the students or the entrepreneurs come from money, I think that desensitizes them to some of the risk. You know, on the flip side, I think sometimes these people take stupid risks, and they don't, you know, think things through. So, you know, I don't know. I think the perception of risk can change where the person's at in their life, you know, what is their safety net. So for example, my wife and I, you know, even though I made up 60% of our household income, we ran the numbers and we said, you know what, this means we might, you know, what's the worst case, right? Which is I didn't make any money. And it might mean that we don't contribute to, you know, our kids' college fund. We, you know, we're not going to start paying mortgage early. We're not going to get that new car. We're not going to go on the vacation. So I think it's about, you know, calculated risk and people's aversion to risk or whether they're risk prone really depends on, you know, kind of their own personal circumstance.
You know, it's interesting on the innovator archetype, our assessment that you took that tells you how you innovate, you're risk taker instinctual, risk takers being one of them, which is very much not just that you lead, but you're more comfortable being uncomfortable, which seems to be kind of a common trait among entrepreneurs. From your research, and we're going to get into the book, The Corporate Refugee Startup Guide. It was fantastic. I loved reading it. But what are traits of the people that tend to gravitate towards starting their own businesses?
You know, there's a lot of research that's done. I mean, I think one of my favorite quotes was from a professor from the University of Chicago, and he'd interviewed thousands of entrepreneurs. And the only common link he found was that people were delusionally optimistic, bordering on psychosis. They were literally that out of touch with reality, because if you look at the numbers, you have to be. You have to suspend reality. So having said that, I mean, and bring it back to, the time that I spend, whether it's mentoring startups, ones that I've invested in, working with students, interviewing VCs and angels. I mean, one of the common links that I find is this isolating a problem, like a big problem that needs to be fixed. I mean, Apple is, an amazing company, and, a lot of the products are built around convenience, but not everybody's going to be a Jobs, and most companies aren't Apples of the world. The ones that I found, where the entrepreneur has the ability to find a problem, isolate the problem and define it really specifically, come up with a solution, and really be incredibly creative on how to address that problem with that solution, and then constantly be willing to, innovate and pivot over and over and over again when they hit that wall. Just say, all right, I got to figure out how to get around this, look over this, jump over this, blast through it, and just keep going and going and going.
What do you think are the toughest things entrepreneurs face that we don't know going into it? It's the stuff that nobody tells you. I mean, I think we've all heard the whole, it's going to be risky. You're going to have ups and downs. It's an emotional roller coaster. But what are those things that we just, I wish people would talk about?
Yeah, I reflected, kind of on this. And as I was writing the book, it was kind of writing the book for myself and my friends. And it turned from a one page blog post to a 240 page book over the course of 3.5 months. And so one of the traps I fell into, and I find others falling into, is, if we're in corporate, we're used to rolling in the office, whatever it is, right? 7 a.m., 8 a.m. We go to our meetings. We bounce into our email. We manage our employees. We look at new projects. We turn off the computer at 5 or 6, answer a few, calls at night or maybe emails. And then it's wash, rinse, repeat the next day. And I think, when you're going into entrepreneurship, you don't have those guardrails and you don't have those controls and you can't close the door on it. It's, I use this term called the fog, right? And you're just diving into this fog and you don't know, where your next customer is coming from. You don't know if you're going to get paid. You don't know what your revenue model is. You don't know what your cost structure is. You don't know where you're going to find that next employee. I mean, it is freaking terrifying. I heard someone describe entrepreneurship recently as eating broken glass and charging into an abyss.
Oh, geez.
and it's pretty, it's pretty terrifying. But I think it does come back to this notion of accepting this fog that you're in and saying, I can deal with this fog. I don't know exactly which direction I'm headed, but, again, I come back to this problem, and if I focus on fixing this problem and helping people, I will get through this.
Do you have any advice for people who are, whether they're trying to take the leap completely or maybe just transition out in a way that maybe feels more balanced for them, given whatever they have going on? What advice do you have in testing their ideas? Because I hear you. I totally agree with the find a really specific problem, find that niche that you can really live in versus, I think we've all heard it, trying to be everything to everybody. But, sometimes you have an idea and the reality is it's only something you want. Other times you hit something. So how do you test that to make that leap into corporate refugee?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I mean, one of the things is, if you have that luxury of time in being able to do it, go out and do the discovery, on the side, that's something I highly recommend. I mean, jumping in without a game plan, is really crazy. I mean, that's what I did. Now, I happen to be on the outside already, but I think doing that discovery, making sure that you're talking to prospects. I mean, literally people that would pay you for that idea. I find that entrepreneurs will go talk to their friends or family members. And one or two things happen, and these are completely polar to one another. Your friends or your family members will say, oh, that's a great idea. I think you should pursue your dream. And the idea is absolute crap.
Right.
And they're basically, you know, you're set sail on the Titanic. They know it, but they want you to, you know, they want to be supportive.
Yeah, they don't want to hurt your feelings, right?
They don't
want to call your baby ugly.
Right. There you go, right? And then, you know, you get other people. You know, my father was like this too. He'd always had a stable career, you know, with a company and said, you know, David, just stick to what you're doing. And so I think part of it is escaping those folks. And when I'm mentoring startups, you know, the easiest thing is to go to get people to have them talk to people they think will validate their idea. And instead I say, who are the people that are really going to pay you? They will literally, and I'll take my money clip out, they will literally do this and I'll start throwing dollar bills in the air, right? I said, when people start doing this, you know you're on to something. But until they start doing that, you really should not proceed with this thing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think the biggest challenge that what we all face, small and big, is we try to validate ideas in a conference room or in a void. And unfortunately, the real vote is if people are willing to open up their wallets, as you said. And you really don't know if an idea is good or not until you know that. You may not have nailed it. In fact, you probably didn't out of the gate. Nobody does.
Right.
But that's the only way to know. So, you know, you have so many great insights. I'm curious. And you interviewed so many entrepreneurs to write the Corporate Refugee Startup Guide, which is your book. So I'd love to talk to you a little bit about the book and any findings that surprised you in all the interviews in the process of going from blog to a book?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, we all know the Peter principle, right? People rise to their level of incompetency. When I was talking to Troy Hennikoff, who is a VC in Chicago, and then also Howard Tolman of 1871, they both said something similar, and this was interesting. They talked about this notion of typically, you know, in a large organization, especially, you become specialized in one functional area. For example, you start out as a sales rep, then you become a sales manager and a sales director, and you might become a VP. And you become really good at those functions. But what happens is you specialize and you have not had this ability to become a generalist. And many times these folks, and I'm not just talking about sales, they could be in product development, they could be in finance, they don't see these blind spots, as I call them. And it almost enables them to jump out and they have these holy shit moments, you know, within a few weeks, a few months. And hopefully they recognize these blind spots and they go out and they find mentors or, you know, other entrepreneurs who generally like to help entrepreneurs. And they fill those gaps in. A lot of times they don't have the capital to bring on other people. And so it's really getting creative and finding networks to, you know, once you've identified those blind spots, to fill in the gap. So that was, you know, one perspective I thought was interesting. Another thing is kind of the, you know, the fallacy about, you know, work-life balance. And people say, oh, I'm going to launch my own company because I'm going to have more time with my kids.
Yeah, right.
And I just it's really hard to restrain myself from laughing. And I didn't, right? I mean, I did an awful job of that. I had my office at my home. There were no doors on my office. And I'd walk through my office on the way to the living room and I'd sit down and work for an hour. And I'd work on weekends and my phone was going off. And I talked to a guy named Aaron Everson, who's been a very successful entrepreneur here in Wisconsin. He sold his first company to Microsoft and sold another one recently. And you know, one of the things he said is the notion of work-life balance for an entrepreneur is just crazy. It doesn't exist. But what he said is when I'm with my kids and my wife, I dedicate that time to them. And what that means is my laptop is turned off. My phone is in airplane mode. You know, it's back in the car. It's at home. I don't miss a birthday. I don't miss a baseball game. I'm 100% focused on them. Do I work more than, you know, most of my peers? Yes, absolutely. But when I'm with them, I'm 100% committed to them and spending that time, you know, psychologically and physically with them.
That's so powerful. I'm glad you brought that up. And launch readers out there, no matter where you are, what you're doing, I hope you really pay attention to that. I always think of it as presence and priority versus balance, because
right.
I don't balance is bullshit. It's just,
right.
And especially as an entrepreneur, but even if you're climbing the ladder. And, you know, I think having every day prioritizing what matters most And frankly, checking your email every 5 minutes doesn't make it come in faster, it turns out. I've learned that lesson the hard way.
Yep. 100% agree.
Yeah. Yep. You know, you're kind of touching upon, though, in all of that, something else that I wanted to ask you about, because I know it's something that I struggle with and have over the years quite a bit. You know, I think it's tough as an entrepreneur because in some ways you have to be good at a lot of things, or let me rephrase that, you have to do a lot of things. And you had just said earlier that, you know, you can specialize to the point where you don't see your blind spots. So what do you do, especially in the beginning, when maybe you don't have the financial resources to hire marketing, sales, product, fill in the blank there, right? Design. Do you become good at everything? How do you think about that to build yourself up for success?
Yeah. So, you know, many times, you know, I just hate to, you know, overuse this metaphor of these blind spots. But one of the things I did is I did seek out SCORE. You know, it used to be the Society for Retired Executives, or the CORE of Retired Executives. I had a guy named Frank Seabricht, and he happened to be in the advertising, you know, sector. And that's where I had started, and he helped me. I joined another group in Milwaukee, almost called a support group, it kind of was, for execs. And then I started, as we got an investment in my second startup, we raised $500,000, and our investors were, you know, quite helpful. And now there's so many resources, right? I mean, there's accelerators that are out there. Many times those folks, you know, even though they accept less than 1% of the people that they bring in, whether it's YC or Techstars or Generator, many times they want to help. Startup Grind, you know, they have 300 chapters in 100 countries, 1 million cups. You know, a lot of incubators have fantastic resources. So I really encourage people to reach out to these resources and fill in their gaps before they actually launch. So they've got this team, like a virtual team, even though they don't need to take on the overhead to help survive primarily, and then obviously thrive after that.
Yeah, it's tough. And, you know, one of the things that I learned the hard way is in the very beginning, I really did try to do it all. And the reality is I didn't do a lot of it well. And I didn't have the time to do all of it. And so I wasn't even focusing on the things I should do to build the business. I was focusing on all the little things.
Yeah,
and I know
absolutely.
That we, I think, intellectually know that. But it wasn't until I kind of had this aha moment of like, oh, my God, I am my own bottleneck.
Right.
That I kind of realized it.
Absolutely.
I want to shift gears a little bit and actually talk about this thing we call success, because it comes in a lot of different forms. And I think oftentimes when we're innovators and trying to do something different or build our dreams, we, you know, say, I want to be successful, but we don't really know what that means. I'm curious how you define success and how you kind of think other people should think about defining it for themselves.
Yeah. So I think it's first of all, success is really personal, right? You know, this is, again, this is something we talk about in the book. You know, what one person defines of success might be, you know, hey, I'm just going to launch my own business. I think another person might chase it for the money, which, by the way, I think is a horrible idea. I find a lot of entrepreneurs that are just chasing it for the money don't stick with it long term because they're not willing to, you know, punch through those walls, those obstacles. And, you know, the ones that I, you know, and I hate to keep coming back to this, the ones that I, you know, see being successful is they've gone out and they want to solve a problem, right? So my first company was called Sales Sherpas. And what we did is we helped small and mid-sized telecoms compete with cable companies and satellite providers. My second company was a software company. And I wanted to help reduce churn, customer turnover. My next company is called Classmunity, and that company provides funding for schools. And my next one is going to be related to helping provide mental health to youth that don't have access to mental health. I have no idea what it looks like. I have no idea what the business model look like, how the service is going to get to these folks. But I just know it's a massive problem. And I want to help do something to fix that problem. So I really think, you know, the success is personal. The only other thing I would add is that I think it's also important to define how you're going to exit this thing. And most people want an IPO, although a lot of startups don't want IPOs anymore. They want to sell that company, right? And the fact of the matter is less than 1%, or actually either of those things are going to happen to them. And so I think, if you can say odds are the business is, you're going to close the business. If you say, look, even if I close the business, it has been a success because I have learned X, or I've helped, Y person, or, my family has been part of this organization. And I think if you can define that exit pattern and realistically shutting it down and framing that still as a success, you don't end up doing things like draining your 401k and getting a divorce and losing your kids and, burning bridges before you really pull the ripcord and you jump out. If you've defined kind of those measures and said, look, I will be successful if X happens, even if I close the doors on that thing, I think that's really important as well.
So how do you define it for yourself now?
Yeah, it's, I think it's no longer kind of the independence and things like that because I've done it, right? I mean, I spend most of my time teaching and working with young entrepreneurs and mentoring them and creating this, this next generation of entrepreneurs and innovators. I think, that's the way that, our country will be successful in the future. I mean, it used to be with efficiency of manufacturing. Obviously, that's not there anymore. I think if we can create, generations of innovators and entrepreneurs, I think that's how we will define the success of the country. And I think if we can help people be innovative and define those successes in helping others, I think that's how people can get there.
Would you, there's a little bit of a flip side to this coin, would you define or even bring up what failure looks like? Or to you, is it all a lesson? Like, how do you know when to quit, right? Or how do you know when to move on?
Right. I mean, for me personally, I sat down with my wife and we personally had a discussion and we agreed that we wouldn't hit we wouldn't tap my 401k. We agreed that we wouldn't sell the house. But we defined what the gives were, right? And the gives were, like I said, the vacations and not getting the car and all of those other things. So we had those stop gaps, those walls in place. And I really respect the people, frankly, that are willing to go in and, and go all in, which it's cashing the 401k and, and doing whatever they need to do to make it work. Those were, a couple of risks that my wife and I weren't willing to take. So, again, I think that's one of those things that's pretty personal. But I do think it's really critically important to define, what that point is when you're going to pull that ripcord, jump out, knowing that it's going to be okay. Maybe you're going to jump on another plane, right? I'm overusing this metaphor, which is another startup. Or maybe you do go back into corporate, which is fine.
So. Yeah, I kind of come from the perspective of none of it's a failure if there's lessons to be learned out of it.
Absolutely.
Right? The failure is not learning 100%. Anything. But I do think if you're going to take a risk or if you're going to do something innovative, put yourself out there, that it's helpful to say, okay, if these things happen, I need to take a second and assess moving forward, or I need to come up with a new game plan, or hey, I need to go back to my corporate job, or I just need to go to a different, startup plane, as you said. In some ways, that gave me comfort knowing not just what the kind of sky I was looking for, but also what the ceiling was too, even though we're told never to, like, you have to be mentally all in. I was, but it gave me comfort.
Right. Yep. 100%. And, obviously I've dedicated my life now to learning and helping students learn and startups learn. So, I totally agree with that.
And I feel that way with innovative initiatives that we do now. It doesn't have to be the whole startup. It can be, or the whole entrepreneurship thing. It can be this initiative we're trying. If we get, if we get these milestones, we're going to keep going. If we get these, we're going to take a step back and assess.
Yeah, that's something interesting with corporate. I think, one of the differences is within corporate, a lot of times we're enabled, I shouldn't even say enabled, we're encouraged not to take risks, right? Because people that take risks and they have quote-unquote failures lose jobs and get demoted. And so that does not hold, you know, people in good stead that want to jump out because they're used to not taking risks.
Right.
And launching their own is quite the opposite. So I think a lot of the organizations that you work with, I'm sure that's one of the things you discuss. And you say, look, you know, in order, you're going to need to take risks. When you take risks, there are going to be failures. You need to kind of define what is okay and then encourage your folks, you know, to be on board with that and let them know that that's all right. And so that they can not just take that chance and that risk once to innovate, that re-innovate the company, but to do it again and again and again.
Yeah, I think you really hit on something. And, you know, one of the challenges I think we all face, whether that's becoming a corporate refugee or an initiative that we're doing, is we tend to create these unrealistic milestones based on previous successes. So just to go into the brand world for a second, you know, if you're a $100 billion brand and you launch a new product, you can't expect it to make $100 billion. You got to back it up and say, wait a minute, what is a tiny milestone that we can hit that shows us a modicum of success. And I think it's true with entrepreneurship too, particularly when you come from the corporate world. I know I face this where I'd go, wow, we're going to make $5 million in the first year because, you know, that was easy in the corporate world. And then I got to my world and was like, whoa, turns out the milestones are not the same.
Yeah, it's funny. I think my first marketing job, I had a $6 million budget, which obviously most startups don't have that kind of budget. Yeah. And I was managed to the
penny. Not even across everything.
my next boss, I won't say what company, basically I was responsible for marketing through 34,000 sales agents. And he told me to keep spending till he told me to stop. And then I went to a $200 marketing budget. And you're really forced. Yeah, you're really forced to get creative and focused in a hurry, you know, when you're moving from, I think, what was a $20 million budget in the end to $200. So,
although correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, this is the experience I've had, and I think with other innovators that I've talked to, that lack of resources really does force you to be innovative because you've got to think differently, and whatever it is that you do has to have 100 times impact. You can't just add to the noise because you don't have the money and the resources to allow that to happen.
It's absolutely correct. I mean, every time I would put a dollar in, I had this mentor that told me, if you put in a dollar back, you better know how you're going to get 10 times back on that dollar.
Exactly.
And that was really good advice, you know, really good advice.
So before I ask you the last question, where can people go to buy your book, connect with you, learn more?
Sure. Books available on Amazon as an ebook / Kindle book or paperback. And I think the price is, what are we at, $12.99 for the paperback and $4.99 for the Kindle version.
Awesome. And LinkedIn or anywhere else they should go?
Yep, absolutely. They can connect. People can connect with me on LinkedIn. It's just David RG on LinkedIn.
So what's the one piece of advice you have for anyone looking to take the leap, and whether that's like we've kind of been talking about being a full-time refugee right away or maybe kind of, you know, transitioning out into that world?
Yeah, I think it really comes down to one world, and that's preparation. You know, that's why I wrote the book. So it's, you know, kind of the value prop of the book, right, is preparing yourself, preparing your family, and launching the ultimate startup. So I think intuitive within that is having a discussion with your spouse or significant other, your kids, about what this could look like, and it's going to look different. And then, you know, preparing yourself and thinking about, you know, the this fog notion. And then lastly, building a really solid business model, making sure that you're fixing a problem, you're focused on the solution. And, you know, you've got to enjoy yourself, you know, as well, and really enjoy the ride. So
let me ask this about preparation, because I 100% agree with you. And I'm probably the least prepared. I'm a do it and then think about it kind of person,
right?
Which, you know, can be good and bad.
Me too.
For sure.
Yep.
When do you know that you're prepared enough, and when versus going over that tipping point of I'm over preparing more because of fear than I am of like, I'm ready to do this?
You know, that's really tough on your first one, especially. I hate to say it was easy for me, but not having a job.
Yeah,
made it easier than, you know, a friend of mine that was making $150,000 a year and it was the sole breadwinner. But, you know, I told him, I said, once you've got orders, once you've got people, you know, POs, people that have said things like, I want to buy this, you know, when can I get this? How much will that cost? Once you start getting all those buying signals, then, you know, you're onto something. And until you're not there, you know, or unless you're there, you really need to be incredibly cautious, because otherwise you might be doing it on a whim or something you think is a great idea, but you're not solving any problems. And by the way, no one's going to pay you for that.
Right. And oh, by the way, which goes back to our whole conversation earlier about experimenting with people who can open up their wallets, not your mom or your husband or spouse or whoever, because they, you're right, they will tell you how much they love it, or they'll dump their fear baggage on you. It's one of the two.
Yeah. Totally.
Yep. Well, Dave, that was fantastic. Thank you. I highly recommend for all of you out there to go read the Corporate Refugee Startup Guide. We met at a conference and I grabbed it and took it home. He was nice enough to give it to me, and it was a great read. And even me, who's been in this, you know, entrepreneurial innovation world for many years, there were a lot of things in there that I was like, oh, that's a really great way to think about that, or a lesson learned that I hadn't thought about. So thank you so much for joining us and sharing that wisdom on Inside Launch Street.
Great. Thanks, Tamara. Have a great day.
So, Launch Streeters, what's your big takeaway? Mine was actually around the fact that we may be looking at risk the wrong way, that risk is based on our quote unquote perception of what we have to lose. I thought that was so fascinating. It just gave me a little bit of a shift on how I look at the risk of things too, that maybe it's arbitrary and kind of made up based on something I think I have or could have. So Launch Streeters, here's your action from this podcast. Go to our podcast and leave a review. Tell people how much you love or what you get out of listening to these podcasts. That if you got something out of looking at risk the wrong way, or like last week's with your innovator archetypes, whatever it is, here's the thing. More reviews equals more amazing guests. And that means more insights like these for you. All right. Tamara, out.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.